I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. We decided we would just leave Earth this hour of the program, and so we are going to do just that and spend a whole hour talking about some very interesting developments concerning Tabby Star. This was a show that we did about 2 years ago, and this mysterious darkness has reappeared 2 years later last Friday. We'll talk about that. And we'll also talk about Mars. Interesting article in Scientific American. The search for life on Mars is about to get weird, and the article ends with this thought: the chances are pretty high that we are Martians. So that's what's on the table for this hour of the program, and we'll be welcoming your phone calls as we always do. Our number is 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. We first did a show on this a couple years ago because we love doing space shows, and it was on the Tabby Star. It was named the Tabby Star after 2 years ago. It's also been called the Alien Megastructure. Do you remember this program? Well, last Friday, Tabby Star was officially losing light again. And it's a very dramatic dimming event. And this time, scientists are ready to go, including our guest this hour, who's at a telescope in West Virginia. And they're trying to figure out what's going on. 2 years ago, this scientist, who's now an astrophysicist at Louisiana State University, analyzed data from NASA's Kepler telescope, and it was going to a star in this whole area that they've been centering on. It's really thousands of stars in a specific part of the universe, and one star, KIC 8462852, behaved like no other star. We'll talk about how it has been behaving, why we're seeing that again, and what it could possibly mean. And we are delighted to have as our guest this hour the same person who joined us 2 years ago. Dr. Andrew Simeon is director of the SETI Research Center at University of California, Berkeley. He received his PhD in astrophysics from UC Berkeley, now holds joint postdoctoral appointments at that school and also the Netherlands Institute for Radio Astronomy and Radboud University in the Netherlands. His research includes extraterrestrial intelligence, the search for that, also studies of high-energy time-variable celestial phenomena and astronomical instrumentation. And as I said, he has had a very powerful telescope right now looking at what's going on with Tabby Star, and this telescope is in West Virginia. So we thank you so much, Doctor, for being with us. Hello.
Yes, hello, Kathleen. It's great to be with you.
Yeah, it's great to have you here again. So did you think this was going to happen 2 years later?
Yeah, well, we didn't know exactly when it was going to happen, but we certainly expected that it would happen during the course of the Kepler mission over a couple of years. Although these dimming events were kind of sporadic and random in when they occurred throughout that mission, we had no reason to believe that the star would stop exhibiting this phenomenon. And of course, that's what motivated the approximately, I guess, 15-month or so campaign that's been going on for more than a year to monitor this star every single night to watch to see if it would dip again. And on Thursday evening, we got what we'd been waiting for, which was news that it was undergoing one of these dimming events.
So people have been looking every night since then. I didn't know that.
Yeah, thankfully it's not actually people. It's robotic telescopes. So every single night, a couple of times a night, usually, the star is monitored by a global network of telescopes that includes a specific network called the Las Cumbres Observatory, which Tabitha Boyajian actually sponsored through a crowdfunding campaign, but also a number of other astronomers and volunteers that monitor the star with their own telescopes. This is not a particularly difficult measurement to do with a fairly large amateur telescope. So there's been lots of people watching it, that watching paid off in spades over the weekend when we caught this dimming event.
So you're watching it right now through a powerful telescope in West Virginia?
Yeah, that's right. So our group at Berkeley works in a field called the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, or SETI. And so we're very interested in this possibility that what's causing the dimming event is some kind of an artificial megastructure or some kind of other technology produced by an extraterrestrial civilization. And I should point out that this is one of the more less likely possibilities for what's actually going on with the star, but nevertheless something that we'd like to explore. So what we're doing is taking a very, very large radio telescope. It's 100 meters in diameter here in West Virginia, and we're pointing it at the star, and in fact have been pointing it at the star for some time, to see if we can detect any radio emission that might be coming from other technology that civilization has, if they exist. So if, in addition to building megastructures, they have radio transmitters like we have here on this planet, we could potentially detect those transmitters with this very sensitive radio telescope.
Mm-hmm. And you've been using radio equipment for a long time to try to detect something from elsewhere, right?
Yeah, that's right. So radio observatories are the most commonly used telescopes in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, because radio signals can get through the space between the stars so easily, and they're relatively straightforward for us to detect if we know where to look, of course, but we don't. So the searching is of course, a big challenge. But it's a very, very good remote indicator of a technology, and in fact, it's one of the best remote indicators of life that we know of. We can detect these signals from very, very far away, potentially, if they exist. So anytime there's a new target or something anomalous in astronomy, we always want to slew our radio telescopes over there and take a look, and that's exactly what we've been doing with Tabby Star.
So why did everybody start looking at this one specific part of the universe where there are thousands of stars, and then they zeroed in on this Tabby Star? Why that part of the universe?
Well, that's a great question. So Tabby Star is in the constellation Cygnus, and it's part of what's called the Kepler field or the Kepler-1 field, which is a small patch of the sky, 100 or so square degrees, where the Kepler mission stared for several years to try to detect extrasolar planets. And Tabby Star, or KIC 8462852, as you might guess from the length of that number, that comes after it, KIC stands for Kepler Input Catalog. It was one of literally millions of stars that was considered for observation in the Kepler mission, and was not sort of thought at that time to be particularly interesting. It survived the down select in stars and ended up being one of the 100,000 or so stars that the Kepler mission took quite a lot of data on. Until the dimming events were discovered, it was a very ordinary F3 type star. And so we were just lucky as astronomers that we happened to be observing it. And, of course, we had Tabitha Boyajian and her team and her very careful analysis that actually led to us discovering that this star was doing something very strange.
Mm. So the dimming is what happens? What's happening during the dimming?
Well, essentially, the dimming is, as the word dimming implies, is simply a reduction in the light that comes from the star. And the reason why we watch stars to see if there's a reduction in their light is that this is a very, very good way of looking for extrasolar planets. So if you imagine that there's a distant star with a planet orbiting that star, if the orbital plane of that system is aligned just right, and the planet passes between the Earth and the distant star, then we would see that star's light dip a little bit as the planet passed around it passed in front of it. And then when the planet came back around, when it orbited the star one time, we would see that dip again. And if we watch very carefully for those periodic dips, we can infer the presence of a planet. And that's how the Kepler mission worked, and that's exactly the measurement it was doing. But Tabitha's star did something very, very different, which is that it showed some, first of all, very, very deep dips that are very, very large, in fact, too large to be caused by a planet, we think, or a planet alone. And also they were random, so they didn't occur at that very regular cadence that we would expect from a planet orbiting the star. And that's what's prompted all this interest, is trying to understand what these random, very asymmetric and deep dimming events might be caused by.
How far away is this star?
It's about 1,500 light years.
So that's pretty far away.
Well, it's pretty far away, I think, relative to the Earth or our solar system, but not very far away in sort of the galactic sense. The Milky Way galaxy is about 100,000 light years across, so it's about a hundredth or so of the distance across our galaxy.
Mm-hmm. And when you're looking through the telescope right now, what do you see?
Well, our observations with the Green Bank Telescope are going to begin this evening. Of course, we've been monitoring it since it was discovered, but this will be our first opportunity to monitor it during one of these dimming events. And basically, what we see with a radio telescope is what we call a radio spectrum. So we see the amount of radio energy as a function of frequency or wavelength. And our instrument works very much like a police scanner. If you turn on that device, it sort of steps through lots of different frequencies looking for a transmission, and if it finds one of those transmissions, it stops. And in the case of a police scanner, it plays the audio from the transmission. That's sort of what our instruments do with this large telescope. They look at many, many different radio frequencies looking to see if there's a radio station, if there's a particular radio channel that has lots of power. And if we find that, we get very excited.
I would have bet you do. You, of all people, would get really excited about this.
Yeah.
Where did this idea come from, and how far-fetched is it? It obviously got the attention on Tabby Star a couple of years ago with the idea of an alien megastructure there, a civilization that was harnessing energy somehow. Who came up with that possible idea, and how far-fetched is that?
Well, how far-fetched is I guess, hard to say. The idea of an advanced civilization building a large structure around their star to collect energy is usually attributed to a physicist named Freeman Dyson, who basically hypothesized that if another civilization were something like ours, and as they got more and more advanced, they needed more and more energy, one way that they might be able to get a large amount of energy is by harnessing energy that was released by their parent star. And he hypothesized that such a civilization perhaps might build very large solar panels that would then orbit their star, and that these might be detectable with astronomical measurements. And there's a number of different ways that we might be able to detect them. I personally don't think that that's a particularly far-fetched idea in the sort of landscape of possible ideas. Certainly, judging by our own civilization, when a technological civilization advances, it needs more and more energy in order to power its technology. And harnessing energy from a star makes a lot of sense. It's obviously a very energetic thing within the system that the civilization emerges from. So I think it's a great experiment to do, and of course there are many searches for these things that have been conducted directly, and I think it's certainly a reasonable possibility for Tabby Star, although it's certainly an unlikely possibility. I think it's by far, in my view at least, the most interesting possible cause.
Oh, no doubt about that.
And so that's, of course, what motivates us to want to follow up on it with as many techniques as we can.
Yes, but considering the time difference here, this would have been a very advanced civilization, wouldn't it? Because it would have been some years ago. How many years ago?
Yeah, that's right. That's, I think, a very special thing about SETI, and I think kind of a philosophically interesting thing about the field. So because this star is 1,500 light years away, the light that we're seeing from the star, the light from the star itself, or a radio signal that we picked up, or the dimming event itself actually happened 1,500 years ago.
Woo.
In fact, the dimming event that we see, whatever is causing the activity that we see from the star, it happened 1,500 years ago. And so we're actually seeing that civilization or that star as it existed in the past. This is something that in the field of SETI is called interstellar archaeology, which means that basically what we're doing is we're looking at the past of other civilizations and actually seeing our own future in the past of these other advanced civilizations.
Ooh, doesn't that stop you in your tracks every day just to think of that?
Yeah, it does. It's a very special privilege, I think, to be able to work in this field.
We have time for a couple phone calls. We're talking about Tabby Star, the alien megastructure, let's call it that, because it certainly is the most interesting possibility of what we're seeing. First noticed a couple of years ago, and our guest this hour was with us a couple of years ago talking about this, and as of tonight, he'll be using this very powerful telescope to look at this dimming to see exactly what is going on. It is a possibility, the most intriguing, that it's an ancient civilization, and we're seeing what was going on there 1,500 years ago with a pretty advanced civilization, perhaps, gathering energy with these huge structures that maybe they are causing the dimming. It could be other reasons for this, but certainly this is something that has intrigued people like our guest. Dr. Andrew Simeon is with us. He is the SETI Research Center Director, and that's the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And he has been studying all of this for quite some time. His research areas include the search for extraterrestrial intelligence and studies of high-energy time variable celestial phenomena astronomical instrumentation. Here's our phone number. Well, if you'd like to join us, we would certainly like to hear from you. I know many of you stay up on this pretty carefully and followed this story when you found out that it reappeared, because the story a couple of years ago caught all of our attention. Our phone number, if you'd like to be with us, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. A little later this hour, we will talk with the author of a piece in Scientific American about the search for life on Mars, which is about to get rather strange. We have spent billions of dollars to look at Mars, but we have not yet found out if there are any convincing signs of life. So do we need to look in another way? We will talk about that hour two. But join us this hour. 800-486-8655 is our number, and this is the Ideas Network. All right, lots of phone calls coming in. Let's go to Jim in Madison for our first caller. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I'd kind of like to reverse this just a little bit. You were talking about this star that's 1,500 light years away, and we're looking at it with our technology. I'm just wondering if this is a fairly high-tech kind of civilization, what would they be seeing from us? Say if they were watching us when we were setting off all these atomic explosions, would they see those, and they, would they think that we were blowing our world up and our civilization has disappeared?
Well, thanks for your question, Jim. That's a very, very interesting question. You're exactly right. So we see that star as it was 1,500 years ago. So if there were a civilization around that star and they looked back at Earth and they had very, very large telescopes, they would see our civilization as it was 1,500 years ago. Now, over the course of life on this planet, there have been a number of changes in our atmosphere that would allow them to certainly tell that there was life on this planet. Perhaps 1,500 years ago, there might have been some very early metallurgy going on the planet Earth that maybe they could detect in our atmosphere. But they would see us, indeed, as we were 1,500 years ago. And thankfully, if they could detect them, they wouldn't know that we had detected atomic weapons.
Hmm. Anything else, Jim?
No, I guess that was it.
All right, thanks. Thanks for your question. John is next in Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Good afternoon. My question to you is, on the erratic beginning of this planet, could it be a planet or a sun very similar to ours with multiple planets on that orbital plane, various sizes that you're seeing going by, you know, a large Jupiter, then a small Earth, and an erratic pattern? Have you viewed it long enough to eliminate that possibility?
So that's a fantastic question. The short answer to your question is yes, sort of. So there's a general kind of premise that we take in astronomy, that because the systems that we're observing have been around for so long, and we know that the age of this star at least is several hundred million years, that we expect that any kind of sporadic event or anything with a short time scale would have already dissipated and happened in the past. In other words, we expect that the system would be in a stable configuration, because statistically that would be the most likely state that we would find the system in. So multiple planets, even though multiple planets can cause a very complicated what we call light curve from the star, so it can certainly cause a very complicated signal, the signal that we see from the star, the light curve, should show some regularity, and we should be able to deconvolve the presence of those multiple planets. Now, there have been some suggestions that there could be some kind of planetary system that could be responsible for the light curve that we see from Tabby Star, but it requires something very, very strange. So it requires some clouds of asteroids, perhaps, that are leading and trailing behind a planet. The planet itself has to be very, very large. perhaps having a very complicated ring system. And there are some constraints that we can put on the existence of that based on other observations that we've done of the system. So the answer to your question is basically yes, it could be a planetary system, but it's a very, very peculiar kind of system, one that really strains our kind of predictive abilities with how planetary systems form.
And how do you even know that it's several hundred million years old?
Well, so there are a variety of techniques. Usually we look at the spectrum of the star, and that allows us to determine its age. And we also look at the stars around it, and that also helps us to constrain the age. But stellar age determination is not an exact science, and there are some error bars on that. But we do know that it's at least that old.
Thank you so much, John, for your call. Dan in Eau Claire. Hi, Dan.
Hi.
Hi.
It sounds like an interesting topic. I'm sure there are many people fascinated by the studies and what's going on. But then there are those like myself and many other listeners, I'm sure, too, who are wondering, what is all this going to accomplish? What is finding out if something has a moon around it or there might have been an ocean there or water? I mean, I'm just curious how all that is funded, where the funds come from, could the funds be used for something on our own planet that's more, that everyone can see how they're used? And these seem to be a lot of theories. So I guess I'd like to give the guest a chance to explain why this should be important.
Sure.
To those of us who aren't involved in science.
Okay.
Thank you, Dan. Yeah, certainly another great question. I have a few answers to that. I guess in terms of the entire landscape of science funding, I think you can think a little bit about science funding in terms of a household budget. So in my house, my wife and I set aside a large portion of our income for our mortgage, and we set aside some for our bills for utilities, and then we set aside some for food and for groceries, and we set aside some for cell phones and for internet bills and things. But we always try to set aside a little bit of money for something fun, to go on vacation or to go out to dinner, something that we enjoy, something that brings us happiness. And I think exploration, learning about the unknown, exploring the unknown, taking that step from the ocean onto land, and then from the land onto a boat, and from that boat onto the soil of another continent. This is the sort of history of life on this planet and the history of humanity. This is really, I think, what defines us as life on this planet, this desire to explore and to find out more about what's going on elsewhere. I think it's worth a small amount of our sort of collective capacity as a civilization in order to try to answer some of these incredibly profound questions. And I think in particular the search for life beyond the Earth is among the most, if not the most, profound question that we can ask as life on this planet. Is there other life? And as human beings, is there other intelligent life? Is there life out there that we could communicate with? So certainly there are lots of things that require our attention and our resources. But I hope that this is one that that most people, certainly I, believe deserves a little bit of attention.
Oh, I hope you find something. Wouldn't that change everything? I don't know if it'd be good or bad. I suspect it might be good. But wouldn't it be remarkable if you really found something?
Yeah, it sure would. It's difficult to say what would happen with our own civilization if we were to have such a realization. But I think it would really be a great step forward in a journey I think we began several hundred years ago when we realized that the Earth wasn't the center of our solar system and that our own solar system wasn't by a long shot the center of the universe. And I think there's probably no other discovery in science that could better put our kind of cosmic place in perspective and remind all of us here on this planet that we do in fact share a single planet, and we all are the same in a very deep philosophical sense, and have a kinship with other life on this planet, both human and otherwise.
And Dr. Simeon, where should we go to get all the latest pictures and all the discoveries that are coming from everybody's telescopes looking at this. Where do we follow up on this?
Well, that's a great question. So our website is SETI.berkeley.edu, SETI.berkeley.edu.
Okay.
We also have a Twitter handle, Berkeley SETI, and a Facebook handle, Berkeley SETI, as well. And we tend to sort of post stories and things as they come up. But any of your listeners could simply type Tabby Star into their favorite search engine, and they would find dozens and dozens of great news stories. There's really some fantastic science reporting out there. Most of it is, in fact, nearly all of it is really, really fantastic. So I really encourage your listeners to seek out more information if they're interested.
Well, how nice to talk to you a couple of years later, and we'll have to do this again before another couple of years. Thank you so much for being
sure,
with us.
Yeah. Thank you,
Dr. Simeon, Director of the Berkeley Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence Research Center. He is right now at this telescope in West Virginia and will be tonight looking at the Tabby Star, as many people who are interested in what they're trying to figure out is going on with this star and the dimming that's happened and happening 2 years after we saw it originally a couple of years ago, perhaps the most intriguing thing, and he doesn't believe it's all that far-fetched, is the possibility of an ancient, pretty advanced civilization harnessing energy, and those are some kinds of megastructures that we're seeing that will have captured energy. It's fascinating. Well, we decided to do a whole hour other than Earth today, and so we're going to be going up to Mars, the next part of the show. Scientific American has an interesting piece. The search for life on Mars is about to get weird. Astrobiologists ponder sending gene sequencers, weather stations, drilling rigs, and more to the red planet. And the author of the piece, who has covered space for a long time, is with us, Leonard David, space journalist. He's reported on space activities for over half a century. His writings have appeared at all kinds of newspapers, magazines, and books. He has been a consultant to NASA, to other government agencies, to the aerospace industry. And in the mid-80s, he served as director of research for the National Commission on Space. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is at K Dunn Show. And Leonard, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it'll be a fun half hour. So we've spent billions of dollars, you've right, to look at Mars. We have had all kinds of spacecraft, photo snapping, orbiters, landers, nosediving, but we don't have any convincing signs of life that have emerged. Why? Are we looking in the wrong places, or we have the wrong equipment, or what's going on?
All of the above.
Ah.
And Mars is high above, so it's a planet that, you know, is calling on us to help figure out this enigmatic place. And it is a little odd. I went to this astrobiology meeting last month, and, you know, you have 700, quote-unquote, astrobiologists, you know, people that are very interested in the search for extraterrestrial life in all of its forms, whether it's civilizations to microbes crawling around. It's pretty telling what's going on. I think they're on, you know, various new wavelengths of trying to figure this Mars puzzle out. And, but, you know, we've had a rover, we've had several rovers now, and I just looked at images this morning from Curiosity, the NASA rover that's been there since August of 2012. And the images are spectacular. I mean, they're just, you know, really exciting to look at this every morning, these new images coming down. But drilling on Mars is hard, and then some astrobiologist thinks you have to dig deep. Those microbes that are there lingering could be in caves. They could be, you know, several feet below the surface of Mars. So one walk-away message, you know, the Viking spacecraft, we had two landings back in 1976 that were specifically designed to ask the question, is there life on Mars? Well, it digs around and it samples things. And it basically said, can you repeat the question? And I think, in my view, we probably have discovered life on Mars. And it's trying to convince the scientific community, which has every right to want every bit of information before they commit to that kind of answer.
Mm.
We're still on another cusp of sending more machinery to Mars, more equipment, more elaborate things. So, but we've, I don't want to make it too much of a downer, but I mean, we have certainly, with Curiosity and all the exploration of Mars, we've spent billions, not only NASA, but other countries. We've certainly profiled that planet. And I think we better understand habitability, that it, if it was there, you know, given what we know about Mars, it's got to be there somewhere.
Hmm.
And so it's an intriguing planet. It's going to pull us to Mars. The amount of hardware going to Mars in 2020-21 is multiple nations are sending probes.
Really?
Oh, yeah. China
is
going to launch their own rover. The United Arab Emirates is going to launch an orbiter around Mars. India is planning their second orbiter. They have one right in orbit right now around Mars. You have Elon Musk.
Yes.
And he is very interested in lobbing his Dragon capsule to Mars in the 2021 time frame. Nobody's on these things, but these are all robotic craft. So, and then we have NASA with another heavy-duty rover called the Mars 2020. It'll have a much snappier name by the time we get that thing launched. But it has all kinds of equipment on there, relatively new and upgraded, you know, off the floor, good kind of science to really dive in one more time and look for life.
Mm-hmm. And you talk in your article about this great progress that we've made in biotechnology. So chemistry labs that can take samples and look at all of this have shrunken down to fit on a computer chip, revolutionizing the medical field, and now will perhaps revolutionize how we're able to examine if there's life on Mars.
Yeah, I that's the big change now. And, you know, these rovers are about a ton. The one that NASA's, Curiosity is about a ton. Mars 2020 will be somewhere in the same ballpark. So the more elaborate equipment you can put on these vehicles and also not take up all the weight by heavy-duty, you know, heavier scientific equipment, we're going to get there. Although, I'm kind of firmly convinced that it's going to take a human expedition to do this right and really, you know, put the squeeze on Mars to cough up the goods. I think it will take humans with robots and all kinds of machines to better understand not only the habitability of Mars today, what it was like, you know, billions of years ago, if life was there, where is it now? And then, you know, the great dream by a lot of space cadets is, you know, making a bridge between the Earth and Mars. And are we really going to go there and settle that planet? Or are we going to change it? Are we going to keep exploring it and try to, you know, tweak out all the mystery out of it? So we'll see. You know, it's fun. I'm getting a little older, though, and I'm getting a little cranky. When you write about this stuff for so long,
yeah, right.
You know, I think your previous guest, you know, when you talk about star systems, you know, when I was a kid growing up, this is like late 50s, 60s, when the space program just got going. When I was a kid, I signed up, by now we should be having interstellar travel.
Absolutely. Right.
We're so far behind.
Yeah, well, who knows how quickly things may advance. What about this water thing? Do you have to discover water, and have we discovered water on Mars? Is it absolutely essential for the possibility of life?
Well, there's multiple camps. You know, the classic line by astrobiologists, when you find water, there should, you know, is there life should be there. It can be the elixir of life. So, and we do see the polar caps of Mars with water ice, and we see certainly huge reservoirs of underground water ice. And not only is that the kind of thing you'd tap if you were an expedition on Mars in the future, because you can convert all that water ice to oxygen and fuel and some other things, and also sustain a crew. Is that the place where we should be trying to dive down in there and see if the microbes have, you know, kind of, you know, have a nice address for life down there?
Let's go to some phone calls for you. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We have this on our Facebook page in case you'd like to read Leonard's full article. Leonard David is a space journalist who's been reporting on, well, so much has happened in space, although we're a little behind the times now. But for many years, we were really going to town when it came to space exploration. So his latest piece is in Scientific American, and it's titled The Search for Life on Mars is About to Get Weird. Astrobiologists ponder sending gene sequencers, weather stations, drilling rigs, and more to the red planet. And, of course, we still have to explore the question, maybe we are Martians. Huh? How about that? Let's go to Carol in Oak Creek first. Hi, Carol.
Hi, thank you. Say, with all the machinery that's being sent to Mars, let's say that you discovered microbes, how would you know these microbes weren't contamination from the machinery constructed on Earth versus an extraterrestrial microbe that's on Mars?
That's a great question, and it's one that is almost a haunting question for Mars exploration because There's a double-edged sword here. Where you want to go to find life, you don't want to have spacecraft that are unsterilized or, you know, have microbes transported from Earth and contaminate that area. So it's the Viking spacecraft back in the 70s was ultra-sterilized to look for life, and it's very expensive. It adds to the whole mission cost, but we're going to have to come to grips with that issue. And there are planetary protection rules. There's an Office of Planetary Protection, not only at NASA but the European Space Agency. So it's a great question, and I think it's a conundrum because the places on Mars that you want to go look for life may be out of bounds for some spacecraft that are roving around or landing nearby. And it's there are rules and regulations being formed as we speak almost, you know, taking a hard look at this issue. But it's a good one.
Mm-hmm. You interviewed some people about this whole issue in your latest piece, and you say that planetary scientists at the Technical University of Berlin, Dr. Schultz Makuch, or however you pronounce his name, you quote him as saying, "I think Mars offers us the highest chance of finding life somewhere beyond Earth." Why did he say that?
Well, I think one of the things that he has spent, like a lot of the people that were there, a lot of time on the kind of instrumentation and looking at results from Curiosity, looking at Viking, looking at a lot of other spacecraft data. One of the things that he was real adamant about is whether or not we are the Martians. I mean, is it conceivable that early in Mars, formation of Mars, it was a happening place for life, and by impacts that come and hit Mars, it has a less gravity than Earth, and all this material rained back down through space and perhaps landed here on Earth and may have been the seed. So there is this kind of an irony or kind of a twisted tale of nature that in some ways going back to Mars with humans, we may be visiting home Earth, a home planet, you know, where life was spawned. And it could have happened the other way because Earth was impacted as well by material from the early creation of the planets, and you know, material came from Earth and landed on Mars. So you have this kind of a cool thing to explore, which is, are we going to find, we may find Earth life, early forms of Earth life still on Mars that somehow crawled around and got down down below the surface, or was there a totally second genesis of life, something? And that raises another question of, if you bring back samples of some life force back to Earth, is that a dangerous? Is it Andromeda strain? Remember that movie?
Yes.
And that's one of the big ethical issues, I think. And one of the things that looms large in all this, if you're a Humans to Mars cadet, is altering Mars. Can you turn up the thermostat? Can you make it Earth 2? And there you get into, and I wrote about it in this National Geographic book about the ethics of exploration. And what right do we have to go alter a planet's environment to suit us, particularly if there's already some kind of life force on that planet?
Mm. When did you write that book?
That came out in October.
It did. How did we miss that? We have to talk to you about that.
Okay, yeah, but it was, I did my best. It was tied to the National Geographic TV series, Mars.
Oh.
And the accompanying kind of volume. But it was all talking to scientists and researchers in the field. And I tried to really make it a book that says, look, Mars is not a slam dunk in all kinds of reasons, not only for robotic exploration and understanding that planet, but also sending people there. What dangers are there? It's a wild place.
I bet it's a wild place, and it's darn far away. It's hard to get home for a visit.
And boy, when you think about, you know, the robots, you know, 20, 40-minute communications, you know, back and forth. When you're on Mars, if you're standing there and you say, okay, mission control, should I turn this left or right? You're not going to get an immediate answer. And so right. By the time you get an answer and they say yes and you've already shut it down or did the opposite, something else, you know, it could be in trouble. So the whole challenge of putting people on Mars is really going to be a engineering challenge as well as psychological,
right,
and ethical, and bunch of other things.
Yeah, I've heard that it can do really strange things to the body. The body at this point really couldn't take a trip to Mars, our bodies.
Well, the good news, and there are a lot of things that are very, actually very compelling about human exploration beyond Earth, and that is the International Space Station has become a pretty impressive testbed for all kinds of technologies. And we've also done a lot of experiments on the astronauts that are up there, and they try to understand microgravity impacts on calcium loss and muscle loss, mm-hmm, and impacts on the heart. And we're getting a good bottom line database on, you know, how do we monitor the astronauts and how do we counter the effects of microgravity in space. I'm a true believer that we're scared of space in a lot of ways right now, and I think technology is going to change that, whether it's going to be artificial gravity or we're going to be able to go to Mars in a week's time and not 6 or 9 months. So things will change, and Mars will become something attainable.
And we'll take more phone calls. Leonard David is our guest. As you can tell, he knows his space. He's been a space journalist for over half a century, and we'll have to have him on about that Mars book he wrote for the National Geographic TV series. So keep your ears peeled for that, because we will schedule it very shortly. We're talking about a piece that he wrote about Mars that appeared recently in the Scientific American. The search for life on Mars is about to get weird. We're taking phone calls for him at 800-486-8655. Back to you, back to him in a moment here on the Ideas Network. All right, back to phone calls. Steve in Drummond. Hi, Steve.
Hi. I'm wondering if there's a scientific reason that we assume other life forms need water to live. Why couldn't they live on methane or liquid hydrogen and eat carbon instead of vegetables or something?
I think you're right on, and I think that was one of the underlying themes in the astrobiology conference I went to. Yeah, there's, you know, that's sort of why I got into the weird life. You know, some of these, in fact, one of the interesting things that's going to come out in the next probably 6 or maybe a year, there's an orbiter, the Europeans have an orbiter that's exactly looking for methane discharges that we know come out of from Mars. Now, whether or not that's signs of life, whether it's a volcanic residues, we don't know. But you're right on. I think we do have kind of a biocentric view of life, and who knows, you know, what we're going to run into. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like the Star Trek, you know, you never know, the tribbles are coming or whatever the name of those things were. So, yeah, I think we got to have our mind open, and the more data we get, we'll, you know, hone that down.
Well, you even mentioned in the article, I can't remember how long ago it was, Leonard, when we discovered these extremophobes here on Earth living in conditions we never thought any life could live on, and you mentioned something could be similar in Mars.
Yeah, extremophiles. Extremophobes, I think I run into at the local bar here, I don't know.
Extremophiles, sorry.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And we're getting pretty clever about finding these things in all kinds of weird locations. And some of them are very reminiscent of the Mars environment, as hostile as it is. So the extremophile collection is growing. And, you know, again, you're kind of left with trying to develop instruments here on Earth because you know you found this kind of extremophile. I think in the article I wrote about some of those biological entities actually go quiescent. They stay dormant for a long time. And then when the climate of Mars might change in the future, they'd spring to life. And so, yeah, we have a database going on these extremophiles here on Earth that we're developing instruments to try to look for those. But like your listener said, you know, you always have a bias because that's the only kind of life we have to kind of look at down here. Mm.
Thanks, Steve, for your call. Ron in Duluth. Hi, Ron.
Hi. I just wondered what kind of technologies you had in mind for reducing the time to travel to Mars to weeks instead of months.
Yeah, I think personally, I believe there's enough things happening in the physics literature, and there's some really clever new engine ideas that NASA is exploring. And you know, I'm going on faith there. I'm a journalist, so I'm going on what people tell me, that we will have space transportation where the long haul to Mars and outward won't be as significantly long as we project today. And why shouldn't I believe that? Every kind of form of transportation down here on Earth has changed, you know. I just flew back from that conference. I mean, I'd still be on the Conestoga wagon if I, you know, piled on that thing. And so I have every expectation that space flight's going to change. And, you know, in some ways, I really think we're in the Wright brothers kind of exploration of space. And so I'm, although I'm cranky and I'm old now, so I want this stuff to happen a lot faster. Not only the speed of the vehicles, but also the timing of it all.
Do we have enough money to go into that, or will it be privately done?
I think both. You know, the government's putting some money in advanced propulsion all the time, and private sector groups have you know, kind of new ideas, new physics that they're looking at. And the other thing you got to keep an eye on is new materials. You know, look at what's happened in computational capabilities on this planet. And we have all kinds of new materials that will take the beating of propulsion and maybe give us a lot more energy than we fathom now. So I'm an optimist on that one.
Right. Well, long may you live so you can see all of this happen, right? Thanks, Leonard, so much. It was fascinating. We'll be in touch with you again to talk more about the book you've written.
Thank you very much, and pack your helmet and get ready.
Okay. Leonard David, our guest, space journalist for a long, long time, and has written a piece. It's on our Facebook page in case you would like to read it, which I'm sure you will. It's fascinating. Scientific American is the magazine, and it's The Search for Life on Mars is About to Get Weird. We thank him for being with us. It's an interesting beat to have covered all these years, isn't it? And it sounds like, from what he said this half hour, that it's going to be even more interesting in the years ahead. Thanks very much to Gretchen Brown and Colleen Leahy for producing this fascinating hour. And thanks to Lisa Nalbandian for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We have another hour coming up, so please stay with us for hour two of our program this Wednesday. We'll be looking at all these weird conspiracy theories that are happening from people who do blogs and somehow that picked up widely and they're not really true and they're conjecture and people believe them and some of them get fed into mainstream media. We'll talk about that.